not supposed to be Saturday?
What day is it today?
Wednesday.
Exactly.
Welcome back to Film Fight Club and 2020. I'm Glenn Falkenstein from Falcon Screen.
Welcome to 2020.
It's finally here. Optometrists everywhere will be thrilled with the amazing marketing campaigns you can do. And there are many, many films that we are covering over the course
and
of the coming
yet,
months.
And yet, at least two out of three of us don't have perfect vision.
True, but they weren't supposed to know that because we're on radio. This is why
but
we
you
do
have
radio.
Perfect vision when it comes to film, which is why we're all here. Film.
We being city filmmaker Chris Evans.
Hello.
And freelance writing critic for Art Nouveau.
Oh, yeah, hello.
So we are back.
Oh, yeah, we're back.
We're back. It's awards season.
I've smoked 50 packs of cigarettes since last time you heard me.
Yeah, we're watching awards
like
ceremonies.
Like a Rolling Stone.
So, yeah, on awards ceremonies, we can cover these if you want us to. We'll touch on the Oscars.
I mean, what's there to say? We say the same thing. It's like Marvel movies. We say the same thing about the Oscars every time there's another one. It's like
they're not relevant.
Parasite and Marriage Story were nominated.
It's cool that Parasite is breaking through. It's historic. It's unprecedented in some ways.
But I just can't get excited about these awards. No. Ricky Gervais' speech was fun. So his stand up was pretty good. I'm
but
he, glad
that's another thing. Like the
Joker's
Oscars,
doing
that's been done.
Joker's doing way
Ricky
too
Gervais.
Well. What, 11 Academy Award nominations.
I think
we live in a society, Glenn.
We live in a society where Academy voters are just glad that they can basically approve of a middle-brow enough superhero movie to get nominated.
It had to be Joker. God. All right. So that's our Oscars coverage. If you would like more
Oscars
coverage,
Oscars. You were good.
You know, reach out, let us know. But we are talking about this week.
Reach out, let us know, and we'll say no. The Oscars are stupid, and we're not talking about them.
Yes, because we're not about validation or approval from mainstream things.
One thing that will be at the Oscars, and we are discussing this week, is the new Greta Gerwig film, Little Women, which is in cinemas now, as well as Bad Boys. Little Women, Bad Boys, Great Double. Bad Boys for Life, I should say. That is the new feature that in the now trilogy, also in cinemas. On the podcast later on, we'll be talking about The Truth, the new creator film, and Sorry We Missed You by Ken Loach, as well as promised The Rise of Skywalker spoiler discussion. So
if anyone still cares about Star Wars and or still needs to feel some cathartic expressions of anger, we've got your back.
But for the moment, we are talking about Little Women, which has been nominated for a number of awards, including Academy Awards.
But not Best Director.
But not... Shame. And is in cinemas now.
It's an adaptation of The Beloved Story by Louisa May Alcott, and it's a new version in the way that it plays with time. It brings in events from into the second novel in the series, Good Wives, and later on, I think. I'm not an expert on these books, so I wouldn't be the one to ask. But it's basically, if you don't know the story already, it's about the March daughters growing up, their lives, romantic entanglements.
To be clear, Joe is played by...
Seeking out their careers.
Joe is played by Saoirse Ronan. Emma Watson is Meg. Florence Pugh is Amy. And Eliza Scanlon, Australia's Eliza Scanlon, is Beth. It also stars Timothy Chalamet, Tracy Letts, Chris Cooper, Meryl Streep, Laura Dern, and a great cameo, which we won't be getting into because it would be spoilers, but there is a great cameo later in the movie.
I'm not sure if it's designed to be this big shock cameo reveal, but it plays that way because how could it not with this actor in particular?
But playing against time.
I gave my impressions of Little Women a while ago in the previous episode, so I'd like to hear first what you guys have to say. What did we think of Little Women?
Yeah, look, it's a really good Greta Gerwig movie. I think it's a genre unto itself.
I wouldn't go that far.
We should note that it's written and directed by Greta Gerwig, based on the novel, obviously, by Alcott.
Yes.
I wouldn't say Gerwig is a genre unto herself at this point. But, I think she's... Honestly, I would say that she's still just developing as a director. I would say this is a big leap forward from
Lady Bird. But you can definitely see certain stylistic flourishes, which is very much...
She has a style, but I don't think she's so developed. It's not like a Bong Joon-ho movie no one else could have done this.
Oh, no. But the playing with time thing, I'm not sure it quite works or even adds anything to the actual narrative, which is actually the most interesting discussion I need to have. Because even without that, I think the story was quite compelling and could be told in linear fashion. It wouldn't have taken anything away
All right.
from the actual experience of watching it.
I like how it played with time. I think that this is probably the main criticism that's pervaded as commentary on this film. I think that certain areas are very distinct in terms of how they're shot and how the characters are made up, whether it be hairstyles or the performances themselves. I think it does require, to an extent, a knowledge of the source material. I've certainly seen the previous film with Winona Ryder and read the book, the first book a couple of times, so that did help. I'd be curious to hear from people who aren't so familiar with the source material. In terms of the narrative framing, what did, however, annoy me was the framing of the entire film within a story. We've seen Game of Thrones conclude on a similar note. We've seen Gilmore Girls conclude with a similar note great infamy.
I don't think it's quite as simple as that, but I can't get into debating you with that without getting into spoilers, so maybe we can discuss this at the end on the podcast.
With pleasure. I think it's better handled here, but I still think it's a tried story device that didn't need to be deployed here.
I think
Even if it does have relevance and resonance within this particular story.
I think the reason why she's doing it is to make some kind of contemporary feminist commentary on the source material, and I think the approach she took drew me out of the narrative in a way that I found jarring. But let's discuss this in the spoilers.
I definitely think the point is that, you know, the fact that, yes, we kind of have moved from the times, but have we actually? Because it's a story within a story, which is equally resonant today as it was back then.
Yeah, I think we can't talk too much more about this without giving away the ending.
Yeah.
So,
another.
But I did like the hairstyles. I mean, let's give it credit.
The production is great.
The thing is, like, Saoirse Ronan's hair and Timothée Chalamet. I mean, whatever is going on with his hair in this movie, it's just having a life of its own. It's just fantastic. Should have been nominated for, like, hairstyling at least.
With what you were saying about not finding the playing with time to be altogether successful.
Yeah.
I think this film as a whole works in patches. I think it's a really good film.
I think, absolutely.
Yeah, but I think there's large stretches of it where the approach of constantly cutting back and forward in time just creates something that feels too busy, and a lot of scenes go past without really resonating. I think at the moments when the whole thing comes together, like towards the end,
it feels needlessly complicated at times.
Yeah, there's moments.
It doesn't need to be.
Yeah, there's moments near the end where there's some nice contrasts with the flashbacks and flash forwards, where I think the emotional effect that Goig's going with this kind of melancholy look, you know, look at the present
really change,
versus,
you know,
nostalgia for the past. I think that there's times that it really works, but perhaps the film didn't need so all-encompassing a flashback, flash-forward structure and could have just used those in a bit of more of a streamlined way when it would be most emotionally effective.
I think what can be more jarring at times is the way pacing is deployed differently throughout the film.
I agree.
Now, Gerwig's style, we've seen it in Lady Bird 2, is to have quite fast-paced, very modern-esque dialogue. This works in some elements where we have to establish several characters' backgrounds. It certainly works to great effect earlier in the film. I didn't think it worked so well in, say, one key sequence where Jo meets Mr. Lawrence, where a very empathetic moment in the novel is sped up and handled very quickly. I think the pacing works better in the moments that are more action-oriented. I'm referring, of course, to the theatre sequences. I think those were deployed sparingly and very well. They were some of my favourite in the film, including the first appearance by Lawrence in that regard, obviously played by Timothée Chalamet. And it also worked very well in probably arguably the most iconic sequence of the novel, which is the scene on the lake, which is very well handled.
Actually, that's a fair point, because a lot of the emotional beats, which I felt needed room to breathe, felt just that
I agree.
They were rushed.
I think if you...
And not because of performance or anything. I think they just required more screen time to be able to actually infuse you and leave you with a sense of melancholy that is intending to leave you with.
Well, when we were, when I first covered this film last year, I compared it to The Irishman. That's a film that also has a ton of incidents happening and quite fast-paced narration. But the difference is that film allows itself the time to cover a lot of things but still give moments some breathing room when they need to. And I think for the amount of story that she was trying to tell here, 132 minutes was too short.
Especially
if it's complicated with the back and forth.
Yeah,
all the time.
Yeah.
There's so many elements that are packed into this film. A lot happens. It's very lean. Yeah. But the moments that resonated most to me are the ones where things slowed down and they were quieter.
Yeah, which it does towards the end.
And I'll highlight a couple. There's one beautiful moment where we see Miss Lawrence, the Chris Cooper character, having a deeply emotional personal moment on a set of stairs. And the camera rested on this and it was beautiful. Another where a character is urging a character to get better. Stunning. Those are some of my favorites in the movie.
The thing is that when the emotional linchpins of the film are all kind of falling into place, which I would say is the last 40 or so minutes of the film. It slows down in a way that it hasn't, it only does sporadically throughout. And that's when I think the film starts to pick up momentum and,
I mean,
you know, it's quite moving.
It's a challenge to adapt the source material. I mean, you know, Louisa May Alcott's novel. Firstly, it's a very thick novel. There's a lot that happens, and it's
very dense. I would say
very dense emotionally, and also in terms of, you know, it's, you know, so much. But also, like, what do you choose to take out is also equally important. And I think this film tries to pack in all the key scenes and everything else in more selective.
I think
so
too.
Of taking the scenes that you wanted to.
What's always interesting when there's a new adaptation is how is this one going to be different? What is the central focus here?
Yeah, and remember, the Christian Bale Winona Ryder version still bears so heavily in fans' minds. It wasn't that long ago.
And yeah, it's like a kind of Christmas. It's on TV. Everyone gather around and watch Little Women. It's got that kind of place in culture now.
Yeah.
This one,
get around TV and watch Little Women. Sorry.
Yeah, it's played forever.
It's like have a cup of warm cocoa and watch Little Women.
Like,
yeah, with a nice swollen rug.
For a generation, it's a formative film.
So the this take, the focus is shifted. I would say to be more about Joe March's writing. It anchors the film at the beginning because of that's something that the flash-forward structure does, to be able to...
The editing and taking and the kind of struggles to be
a
writer. Yeah.
A moment from closer towards the end of the timeline involving her writing near the beginning of the film, so that idea is anchored throughout the whole narrative.
I mean, who wants to be a writer in this economy? Anyway.
And it comes to be the climax of the film, you know, the centered around her writing. I found that stuff really effective. I wish the film would have gone on out of its way to be even more focused on that and diverge more from the original narrative, but it feels torn between...
doing justice to the original.
Yeah, trying to pay homage to the original and feature all of the main... or feature the significant events from the original narrative, when it would have been better to try...
Shift that point of view and just focus on this other thing that you're now
exploring. Yeah. But then it tries to... I'll get into this more with spoilers later, but to speak on it in vague terms, it feels a little bit smug to me in the way that instead of just committing to being something different, it tries to have it both ways and offer some fourth wall-breaking commentary on the original narrative. And for a film that was so earnest and did such a good job of drawing me into Joe March's interior world and her writing and her quest to find inspiration again, I was just suddenly drawn right out of the narrative.
Turning to some of the performances, which are generally very good, Gerwig has brought together an amazing ensemble
of
actors. Florence Pugh was my favorite in
that
show.
That was a deserving Academy Award nomination. She got a Best Supporting Actress nom.
She did. Chalamet is excellent.
I like the Oscars.
Emma Watson... it's one of my favorite performances from her.
She's
not
fine.
On the level of many of the other co-stars, in particular Saoirse Ronan and Florence Pugh.
She has less to do, so it's fine.
But also, like, I don't think Emma Watson, she's a competent actress. She's never been a great one, so it's okay.
And I will say I liked Laura Dern in this. However, I didn't like her dynamics with a lot of the other characters. She didn't really have a great chemistry with Saoirse Ronan, which is strange to say. I've never really criticized Laura Dern's performance before. I don't think it's on her. I just don't think they're as effective a working pair as Dern and, in fairness, Ronan has been with many other performers as seen within this film and others. Their scenes didn't resonate so well for me. That's distinct as from Dern's pairings with some of the other characters in the film, but I felt she was distinctly out of kilter with many of the other performers herein. She was good. It was just operating on a different tenor to her co-stars.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing bad or something, you know, out of flavor to say, but the performances, they were all competent.
I think they're,
but
actually
Florence
really
Pugh is definitely the standout.
This may be her favorite performance from her.
What's the name of the Florence
Eliza
Pugh
Scanlon?
Excellent.
Yeah. Beth.
Yes, Eliza Scanlon did a really good job as Beth. Beth could have been a much more treacly, manipulative character in less sensitive hands.
But see, that's the thing. The complaint goes back to the narrative because this film doesn't really know what route it wants to take, whether it wants to actually be an original story with a shift in focus or actually be an adaptation. We have so many of these threads which could be like more deliciously explored. This could have gone
deliciously. Would thou like to live deliciously?
You know, there could have been more you know, gobsmackingly beautiful or whatever.
Lip-smackingly. There's a very, there's like a food thing going on here for some reason.
It's all right.
That is Little Women? Yeah.
Go watch it. It's not a bad...
We've been picking it apart for a lot of this, but...
It's still a good film.
It's actually really good.
Yeah.
It's absolutely worth seeing.
It's
better
really
than
nice,
seeing Rise of Skywalker again,
of
trust me.
Yeah,
it has really nice painterly cinematography.
Oh yes, actually, yeah.
The characters feel like they have interior life. There's a lot that's great about it. Meryl Streep was hilarious, by the way.
Yeah. She was very fun as Aunt March.
Yes,
Auntie.
So that is in cinemas now, and we'll be back in a moment talking all things Bad Boys for Life. Stay tuned.
We're back with feature albums, and our first for 2020 is from English rhythm rockers Field Music. Fronted by Peter and David Brewis, Field Music get conceptual on their new record, Making a New World. Full of brightly spun melodies and elastic grooves, you'll hear it on Breakfast, Drive and Static, where two SCR supporters can win a copy. Making a New World by Field Music, feature album on 2SCR 107.3. Stories, ideas, music.
It's here. Sydney Festival is taking over the city once again, filled with cabaret, music, theatre, art and more. From January 8 to 26, experience some of the best international and local performances. From Holly Herndon to Yarning Circles, or the Bankstown Poetry Slam to one of the UK's top illusionists, you'll find plenty of inspiration for a great night out. Check out the full program of events at sydneyfestival.org. 2SER is a media partner of Sydney Festival.
Don't miss the best new queer cinema from around the world at Queer Screen's 27th Mardi Gras Film Festival. With over 130 films, there's something for everyone. The programme spans everything from The Glass Room, an epic love story of two women trapped by war, And Then We Danced, a powerful film about a young gay dancer defying the odds, to Bit, the transgender and lesbian vampire flick for lovers of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. These and more are showing from February 13 to 27. See the full programme and grab tickets at queerscreen.org.au. 2SER partners.
Sydney Outdoor Bed Cinema is back. Watch a movie under the stars from the comfort of a bed. Yes, that's right, a bed. The comfiest cinema experience, movie in bed, has landed on the rooftop of the entertainment quarter. Get food by Fratelli Fresh, El Camino or the Bavarian Beer Cafe delivered to your bed for the perfect night out this summer. Book your bed online at movieinbed.com. MOVINBED.com. 2SER sponsors.
And welcome back to Film Fight Club, where we are talking with Glenn Falkenstein, Chris Evans of Rotten Eru, and we are talking Bad Boys for Life, the third in what was now a Bad Boys trilogy.
Bad Boys, it's, Bad
there's
Boys,
going to be more.
What you gonna do?
It's going to be more.
There's never going to be an ending to any movie series ever again.
The Bad Boys universe.
Every franchise goes forever.
It's now a universe.
Until people stop buying tickets.
This is it Boys with B-O-I-Z?
This is a sequel can you imagine? This is a sequel to the 1995 classic. It is a classic by Uncle Bay, starring Will Smith.
Sound like you just said Uncle Bay. Like, yeah, that Uncle Bay with his explosions and his leering shots at models. Him and his
they're not leering. They were just lingering for a second or two.
A lot longer than the second you've seen the third Transformers film, dear me. But he's not directing this. This is directed by Adel Il-Arbi and Bilal Fallah. Michael Bay does appear in this. He has a cameo. Obviously, Lawrence returns as Mark Spinett and Will Smith as Mike Lowry. And we also have Joe Pantoliano returning and joining the cast, Vanessa Hudgens, Alexander Ludwig, Paula Nunes, Charles Melton, who plays Reggie in Riverdale. And yeah, so this is the third entry. It is set, obviously, in Miami.
The first Bad Boys came out in 1995. The second one came out in 2003. This one's more than twice as long between the first, the second and third Bad Boys.
The question is,
Sony are
why?
Just really desperate for franchises right now. It's the same reason why we're having a new Ghostbusters, even though the last attempt to do a new Ghostbusters fell flat on its face.
All right, Boys
is back.
Bad Boys is back, and honestly, I went back and rewatched the opening credits for the first Bad Boys film. That is better than this entire movie. I'm going to say why.
Okay.
The opening credits are fun because they take simple shots and great music, and Michael Bay elevates it with his absolutely bombastic style. These directors are not capable of doing this, and it shows.
Like, the worst of Michael Bay is much, which you can see, I would say, in Bad Boys 2 at times, It's much worse than anything this film has to offer. Because Bay go- this
Wait,
film is
you
just
mean,
basically...
You mean much better?
No, no, no. Hear me out. The worst that Bay does is much worse than anything in this film. Because this is basically tastefully bland. Whereas Bay, as shameless as he is, really goes there into some pretty sick and unwarranted sources of humor, I would say, in Bad Boys 2. There's some genuinely distasteful stuff in that movie.
They destroy a village. They destroy a Cuban village.
They also destroy just cadavers, and it's played for laughs, and the whole thing just is just kind of sick.
Oh, you're in there? Yes.
Yeah. Bay's sick, politically incorrect humor runs through all his films. Even the Transformers movies, which are aimed at kids, have some arguably... The original Bad Boys, no. Bad Boys 2, yes.
Absolutely,
but there's very similar humor even through Transformers, which is ostensibly aimed at kids. So that's the worst of Michael Bay. But on the other hand, the guy genuinely has panache, right? As you say, his style is so bombastic, so over the top. He strings together some genuinely interesting styles of shooting action. He has been decried for his all over the place rapid cutting style, but it's genuinely a style.
Yeah, go back and watch the whole film was over $23 million. Go back and watch the foot chase from the hotel lobby in Bad Boys 1. It only takes place for a few blocks. There's nothing as interesting in this film as that great shot of all the bad guys running down a stark white corridor, as Mike Lowry, all practically shot, running down the highway to save Marcus, where the most crazy thing that happens was Marcus jumping on a car. Here, where you get literally several times the budget, you feel you have to dial it up. But it's but that all only means you bring green screen because the actors aren't willing to do this, or aren't able, or the studios aren't willing for their actors to do these practical effects.
It's
disengaging.
This is also a much cheaper film. I mean, by today's standards, $90 million... I would say, factoring in the way that budgets have inflated, this is probably like half the budget of Bad Boys 2, which I think cost like $130 million or something like that, 16 years ago. It looks cheap. And the thing about the way that the action's shot is that it's not... It feels like a third-generation Xerox of Michael Bay's style. Like, you can kind of sense that it's colorful and flashy, but not in any interesting way, because all the best ideas happened 16 years ago and we're seeing the after image.
There's one interestingly shot, composed shot in the entire film, and it's a low angle shot of a character running along a grate, which is like, oh wait, this is different, but then we just revert to the very statically shot Uwe. There is also a great shot where two characters come out of a window and it's done as a surprise, given the way the camera is set back. Otherwise, it's so traditional in how it's done.
The visual effects
like Bad Boys
are bad,
too,
by the way.
Oh, but at least there were some more engaging scenes. I can literally count on one hand the interesting scenes in this film. The scene where a character vaults from a balcony, and one scene where a car vaulted off a truck, but this scene was submerged in so much green screen.
Yeah, that's the thing when I say the visual effects are bad. It looks low budget. It's too obvious that they've not had the budget to even really stage some of this mayhem. Whereas when you compare it to Bad Boys 2, which gets so ridiculously bombastic and in the way that the scenes are staged, but they felt like things were actually really there and really happening.
The third good scene was the one with the accountant. On the matter of how Bad Boys is shot, it feels like Bad Boys 2 felt like they made them superheroes. And this, again, doubles down on that. They're just normal people. Why do we have to have superheroes?
Because every movie, every action movie, every blockbuster has to be about elevated style. Things keep getting bigger and bigger and badder and bigger.
Like the finale in this movie, which is just a headache.
Yeah. This film is just so 2020. Like the way that... it's such a bizarre plot. I'd love to spoil the hell out of it, but basically it's suddenly... All right, I'm reminded of an essay Matt Zolasites wrote last year, I think it was, where he was talking about the new future of media and the franchise addiction that we have well and truly entered into. And one of the points he made was that soap operas have gone away on TV in the prime time, but soap operas have entered into every other genre of entertainment. And there are some real soap opera-y aspects because in this film, and it makes sense that there would be, because how else are you going to get people involved, hooked enough to stay in and come back for the next installment? Yeah. Marvel and Fast and the Furious have really perfected this formula. So suddenly there's a moment in this movie where a character says like, oh, this sounds like a telenovela. Yeah, it does. It doesn't give you brownie points for being self-aware of that if the script is still a crappy soap opera. But why would you do that to Bad Boys of all things? Like, why do I suddenly care about the interior life of Mike Lowry, who is just like a shallow Will Smith quip machine cool guy?
To give everyone an idea, there is a shameless retconning of Mike Lowry, which moreover, in addition to a number of scenes in this film, takes place in a very shallow attempt at being overly emotional, just exposition dump. I reminded of that terrible scene in The Accountant where the whole film grinds to a halt for 10 minutes so J.K. Simmons can just explain what the hell is going on. One of these sequences belongs to Joe Pantoliano, and he's good, and it's generally nice
seeing him in this. Joe Pantoliano is so funny in all these movies.
But he's like Kylo Ren in The Force Away, in Rise of Skywalker. Like, he doesn't want to have to sell the style, he's getting paid a lot of money for it.
Right. He's a really loud rendition of the classic angry, you've destroyed the whole neighborhood, police detective. But his character is this more Michael Bayed up version where he's just constantly yelling and the camera's swooping in his face and he's got a funny way of talking. And yeah, it's great. He shows up here and gets his paycheck. But there's nothing that feels like it has any real energy for me. For me, the whole movie was basically moribund. It's fast paced, but I don't buy the drama. I don't care about these cliche Sicario villains, cartels that they're up against.
It's just as bad as villains in the first couple of films. There's things I will say that I did like about it. The Charles Melton and Alexander Ludwig characters were good. There was some good character development there. Not nearly so much given to their female counterparts in this new Fast and Furious type squad. Another thing,
one thing, they're definitely looking to Fast and Furious, but one thing all the Bad Boys movies, especially Bad Boys 2 and 3, do is feel like a really expanded Miami Vice episode with like the squad tracking things down, the driving around in Miami, being cool.
On that, you know, it's honestly nice to see the squad together. Like, they have a genuine charisma together. They are good together. And while a lot of it is Martin Lawrence Will Smith saying, oh, you know, we ride together, die together, there's just there's a recurring reference to hair dye, which is actually very touching.
And
honestly, the two of them hanging out with some of the better bits of this film.
Yeah, look, I think they had good charisma, especially Martin Lawrence. I didn't expect Martin Lawrence to
Star of The Beach Bum.
Yeah, I didn't expect him to be as good as he was in this. He was funny. I think it's the writing that was contrived. When it's trying to create wedges between the characters and keep the soap opera shenanigans running along, Martin Lawrence basically made it believable where the writing couldn't carry the weight of it.
Yeah, on the matter of Martin Lawrence, the actors aren't leading us into the physicality of as they did in the earlier Bad Boys.
They're too
There's
old.
One scene where Martin Lawrence plays this up. It's a great comic effect, and it's contrasted with how Will Smith goes about it. It's very funny. The film will instance that more could have worked, but no, it's pretending that they want to pursue the same level of kinetic energy that they did in the first and even the second Bad Boys film.
Can you believe that it looks like we're going to get a Bad Boys 4 now with this big success, and clearly they're up for it, and yet they called this one Bad Boys for Life? Missed a big opportunity for Bad Boys for Life.
Yeah, and as did Fate of the Furious, calling themselves F8 of the Furious. But
they did pick that number intentionally, I think.
Yeah, they did effectively. So, yeah, they missed out, and there's going to be another Bad Boys.
I
don't care.
I just don't care.
No.
Are there any franchises that you're still interested in?
James Bond, which we will cover later in the year. So that is Bad Boys for Life. It is in cinemas now as Little Women. On the podcast, please stay tuned if you listen to podcast, or just subscribe at iTunes and Spotify. We're going to be talking Sorry I Missed You, The Truth, and Rise of Skywalker spoilers.
At the end, we might tack on a couple of spoilers for Little Women and Bad Boys for Life if you're interested in hearing what we have to say about those ones.
Next week, we're going to be covering the new Terrence Malick film, A Hidden Life, The Gentleman, Bombshell, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, starring Tom Hanks.
1917.
And Seaburg, the new Kristen
Stewart
film.
That's a hell of a lot of movies.
Yeah.
Feel like half of those are going to be on the podcast.
Oh, yeah. Well, The Hidden Life will definitely be on
Hidden
the main
Life,
show.
Hidden Life, 1917?
Yeah.
Bombshell, maybe?
Yeah, I think that sounds good. But we will be covering the new Malick. We're seeing it tomorrow night. We are quite
excited.
We've seen it already. But
yeah, I'm Malicked out.
Well, that's high praise. I never want to watch another Terrence Malick movie again. 5 stars.
It's not hidden praise. It's quite apparent.
Okay.
And another thing to look forward to, which we'll be covering in 2 weeks, is The Lighthouse. If you want to catch it, it's playing at Westpac Open Air on Saturday, or at the Fantastic Film Festival launch at the Round of Grits on Sunday night. I'll be there.
There's also
check it out there.
Another session of it coming up on the Thursday after that, which I will be at for Ritz members. Become a member. The Ritz is great. At the Art Gallery of New South Wales this week, Bedevil by Tracy Moffat, which is three Indigenous supernatural stories, is playing at 2 p.m. And are there any other goings on about town?
There's the Miyazaki films playing at the Studio Ghibli films, I should say, playing at the art gallery, but I think they're all booked
they're
out.
They're all sold out. And I think they are all Miyazaki films.
Yeah. All Miyazaki films.
So kill someone if they've got a ticket and get their ticket.
So this has been Glenn. Please don't do that. This has been Glenn Falkenstein, Chris Edmondson for the Royal. Unless it's My Neighbor Totoro where it's okay. Stay tuned for the Sonic Assassin. We'll be back next week. Tune into iTunes, Spotify. Have a wonderful night. Enjoy movies. It's great to be back. Good night.